You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, a course for speakers to promote the idea of threefolding. Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 7. Given in Stuttgart on February 15, 1921, in the evening. Earlier, I described to you how the human being must be placed in the middle of the considerations to which you will be applying yourselves in the near future. If this occurs to the fullest possible extent, then it might be able to put right a number of things in the current worldview that will lead to catastrophe, as I also showed you in my last lecture. Now, we must turn toward a few things that, at least by way of example, will illustrate what is connected with this claim, that the human being must be placed in the middle of our social considerations and the actions to be taken in the social realm. We have among us now a huge number of slogans and catchphrases and the like. What people express to their fellow human beings is filled ever more with these phrases. We are living in an age of empty phrases. And a reality that is guided and directed by empty phrases must quite clearly collapse in upon itself. This is connected to the basic phenomena of our present evolutionary moment. From the great number of things that are present in social life, let us take one particular example and consider it, as it is discussed quite often now. We are hearing from several people who want to participate in discussions of social questions that the proletarian movement is revolting against unemployment income, against unemployment benefits. Now, it is certainly the case that something real lies behind such a claim, but by and large that something is entirely different from what the people who make such claims think. You must first be clear about the fact that you have to get behind the scenes through observation of social events and not through concepts, until you see what, quote, unemployment income, close quote, and, quote, unemployment benefits, close quote, actually are. People have talked about these things in a great variety of ways. There are people, even Bismarck is among them, who spoke about this quite differently. They spoke of productive classes, but meant working classes. They were, however, of the opinion that farmers, tradesmen who work with their hands, for example, and people in other similar lines of work are productive people, but that teachers, doctors, and the like, for example, are not productive people, that what a teacher does, therefore, does not count as productive work. You know, perhaps, that Karl Marx made an economic discovery that has been much talked about precisely in the interest of setting this productive work in the proper light. Karl Marx's discovery is, of course, the famous, quote, Indian bookkeeper, close quote. This is the man who, somewhere in a little Indian village, where the other people worked with their hands, sowing and reaping and picking fruit from the trees, in this village his job was to keep the books for all these various activities. And Karl Marx decided that all the other people in this village were doing productive work, and that this bookkeeper was deriving the means for his unproductive life from the, in quotes, surplus value taken off the top of the output from the other's labor. And from the case of this unlucky Indian bookkeeper, many conclusions have then been made that have now become fairly typical of a certain kind of economic thinking. It goes without saying that the activities of a teacher can be categorized within the social process as, quote, unproductive activity, close quote, just as Karl Marx categorized the activities of his unlucky Indian bookkeeper. But let us consider the case in this light. We have a teacher who is an able man, as able as any full or complete human being. He teaches and nurtures very young children, elementary school age. And to make things simple, our theory will not be hampered by this, Let us say that all of the children that this teacher nurtures and teaches become cobblers. And he enables them to be even more clever through his expertise, through the fact that he is able to develop the capabilities in his students that allow them to think cleverly and move neatly into their life of employment as cobblers, through his practical use of all manner of educational techniques. And now they become such terrific cobblers that, let us say, they are able to produce in 10 days as many boots as others produce in 15. Now, what do we have here? You see, all of these cobblers who were taught this way are doing productive work in a true Marxist sense. If this teacher and his expertise had not been present, if he had been an incompetent teacher, then the same amount of productive work would have been done in 15 days rather than 10. If you count up all of the shoes made by these now-grown children during those 5 extra days that were spared because they had a skillful teacher, then you can rightfully say, quote, all of these boots were, in essence, made by that skillful teacher, and at the very least, in the economic process, in everything that belongs to this economic process, which is to say, everything from it that supports human beings. In all of this, the teacher was actually a productive element. His being lives forth in all of those boots produced during those extra 5 days. Close quote. What is happening here is that people have taken such a short-sighted view of things that they identify Marxist, in quotes, productive work only with the work of the cobblers, and see the work of the teacher as unproductive work, meaning work that supports itself on the surplus value of others' labor. But reality is rendered false by this way of considering things. We can take up another consideration that does not tend one-sidedly in one direction or another, but rather takes up the whole process of social life. If we think about it economically, purely economically, then we have to ask, what actually connects the teacher to his physical livelihood? In economics, is it really any different, economically speaking, any different from other sources of income? Does it really differ, this is my question, from something that, speaking as a Marxist now, is otherwise abstracted from physical labor and given to another person? Economically speaking, it is absolutely no different. We are dealing with the following here. Let us assume that something that is called surplus value is spent on teachers. This value circulates productively, in the manner I have just described, into the whole economic process. Let us assume that it is given then to a financier, to a man who we call a pensioner in the truest sense, who actually does nothing more than what we typically expect of a coupon clipper. Well, is the economic process depleted by the fact that he clips those coupons? Is it not the case that this person eats and drinks and clothes himself and so on? He cannot live on what is given to him as surplus value alone. He lives on the things that other people do and make for him. He is simply a site where work, where the economic process, is transformed. If we consider the matter objectively, then we can really only say the following. Such a person, living somewhere as a well-financed pensioner, this transformation point of the economic process, is a part of social life, the way in which a still fixed point is part of a scale, of the scale's arm. This point has to be there, this fixed, still point on the scale's arm. All of the other points move. The one fixed point on the arm of the scale does not move. It must be there, though. For things must be able to go through this process of transformation. In other words, from an economic perspective, we cannot say anything definitive on the matter. At most, we can say that if the number of these fixed points, these coupon-clipping pensioners, grows too large, the others will necessarily have to work more, work longer hours. But in reality, this is not the case anywhere, because the number of these pensioners in relation to any population as a whole does not approach that point. And because little more than nothing can result from an attempt to change anything on the basis of the current state of our social life and process. So, we cannot really think about things in this way. And if you go through the Marxist literature, you will see that the demands laid out there to find something that is responsible for all the so-called ills of social life, such as so-called unemployment benefits, that these demands lead to a slew of conclusions, to conclusions that are not justified. They do not prove anything. They would be able to prove something only if, somehow, the economic process were altered in some fundamental way, if the pensioners were to suddenly not receive their pensions. But this might never be the case, so we cannot get anywhere near the real issue with this way of thinking. What we really need to be doing is making sure that we see clearly that such fixed points must necessarily exist in order to bring about the needed transformations, the turnover of economic life. There is, in fact, a surplus value that is economically consonant with all of the definitions that Karl Marx gives of surplus value, one that is also consonant in all of its functions, insofar as one thinks purely economically, with the functions of surplus value in Marx, namely taxes. In both its origins and its functions, a tax is exactly the same as Marx's surplus value. And the various socialist governments, wherever they have taken power, have not exactly proved to be particularly strong opponents of surplus value in the form of taxes. It is precisely when it comes to such things that this theory reveals its patent absurdity. The absurdity of these theories is never demonstrated in their logic, but only in reality. Anyone who strives to assess things from the perspective of reality must say the same. So long as we remain within economic life, it is impossible to give the concept of surplus value any sensible meaning. For as long as we remain within the realm of economic life, we are always dealing with the turnover of economic processes. And this turnover can occur only because there are fixed points of transformation. Whether these are found in the state or in individual pensioners is of secondary importance when we are thinking about things purely economically. Therefore, it is necessary to point out that everything connected to a concept like, quote, unemployment income, close quote, or unemployment benefits has nothing to do with economic thinking, but is simply a question of resentment. You look at someone who is receiving unemployment benefits and see them basically as nothing more than someone who is lounging about, not working. A legal or perhaps even moral concept has been smuggled into economic thinking. That is the originating phenomenon here. In reality, we are dealing with something quite different, namely that our human life process, the process of our civilization itself, cannot be maintained if people actually bring about the things that some are striving for when they make up empty phrases like, quote, the right to the whole produce of labor, close quote. There is no possibility of speaking about a whole produce of labor if you consider the following example. Suppose I became a cobbler and worked with more expertise than I would have worked had I not had a skilled teacher. Any possibility of claiming my right to the whole produce of labor is cancelled out. Because where does that whole produce of labor come from? Certainly not from just the collected product of the present. The teacher who taught me might be long dead. The past merges with the present, and the present flows then into the future. Trying to get a picture of the kinds of things people create within the whole economic process, trying to see this with short-sighted concepts, is absurd. Something different comes about as soon as we say to ourselves, quote, well then, thinking about it purely economically, there can be no talk of someone receiving the whole produce of labor, because it is impossible to even understand this concept. You cannot draw its boundaries or contours. It does not exist. It is impossible. Close quote. But something different comes about the moment that we consider reality. In reality, we find these points of transfer. people who receive part of the output of another who does physical labor. Now, assuming this recipient is a teacher, in that case, the teacher also does productive work, as I described to you earlier. But then let us assume that the person is not a teacher, but rather a proper coupon clipper. Let us even assume that we have not just one coupon clipper, but two. One of them clips coupons in the morning, then smokes a few cigarettes after breakfast, reads the morning paper, goes for a walk, has lunch, sits down in his rocking chair and rocks for a while, then goes to the club and plays whist or poker or something like that, and this is how he spends his day. Now let us consider the other who, let us say, busies himself with the establishment of a scientific institution. Someone who, in other words, turns his thoughts toward the establishment of a scientific institution that would not have come into existence if this man had not been a coupon clipper. If it was to have been established by the people who are around and doing the work that allows him to clip his coupons, then it would certainly have never been established. He establishes it. And in this scientific institution, after 10 years, or perhaps even 20 years, an extremely important discovery is made. By the means of this discovery, productive work is still carried out in a similar way, but through an even more productive process than what the teacher was able to teach his children who became cobblers. In this case, there is a certain difference between coupon clipper A and coupon clipper B, a difference that is extremely significant for economics. And we have to say that the whole coupon clipper's process was an extremely productive one in the whole of human life. This question cannot be decided from a purely economic standpoint. It can be decided only if something else is there outside of economic life, detached from economic life, unaffiliated with economic life, that leads people who derive their livelihood from the output of the whole to give back what they have taken away. In other words, when a free spiritual life is present that moves people to become not simply financiers, but to make some use of the spiritual powers that they possess, or even the physical powers that they possess. At precisely this moment, when we see through to things as they are in actual life, we will be led to the necessity of the threefold social organism. And above all, with this complete vision of life, we will be made aware of the fact that all of the nonsense that is brought forward by national economics and even by pragmatic people is fundamentally useless, that ultimately something different must enter the minds of human beings, namely a complete consideration of life. And this complete consideration of life, this is what finally leads to the threefold social organism. Therefore, we must make an effort to make these ideas ever more widespread. We also must not disdain to point out just how short-sighted modern-day practical life is. We must make a connection between these two activities, presenting what is positive about threefolding, while being the harshest critics of the various spiritual streams that exist at present. We have to become familiar with these spiritual streams and become harsh critics of them. This is the only way that we will be able to hold up a mirror to the absurdities that exist today. This is the only way that we will move forward, that we will be able to succeed. And what we are able to teach people through these means, we must simultaneously present to them in such a way that they are able to sense that we work with real concepts. You see, a person who makes boots is absolutely a productive person. But according to Marxist concepts, someone who makes little beauty items is just as productive. If you are guided simply by the idea of physical labor, then making these is just as much a physical labor as making boots. It is thus a matter of looking at the whole process and taking from that a picture of how what someone does fits into the whole process of social life. People must develop a feeling for these things. There is no other way forward. However, it is also necessary for us to respect the habitual thinking of our contemporaries. You have to be clear about the fact that if you were to go out right now to talk to people for an hour or an hour and a quarter about the kinds of things that I am presenting to you, they would start to yawn and finally would have to leave the lecture hall. Happy that your talk was over, longing for a healthy nap. They would find it difficult, much too difficult. People have grown totally unaccustomed to following along with thoughts that are taken from reality. Because people have heard only abstractions, as school children they got used to following along with abstractions, because of this, humanity has become mentally lazy. Humanity is terribly lazy in its thinking right now. And we have to be sensitive to this, but in a way that is useful. Therefore, we should allow stories to enter into our lectures about the things that have already developed from anthroposophical spiritual science. Maybe we should tell people fewer anecdotes. It can certainly be very helpful for the mentally lazy people of the present to occasionally interrupt a complicated lecture with anecdotes, but we have better ways to spend our time. In those in-between moments, being careful to introduce it properly into our train of thought, let us tell them about our Waldorf School, about Eurythmy, about our college-level courses, about the Commenda Talk. These are things that interrupt the course of thinking, which is first and foremost a pleasant diversion for people. They do not need to think as much. And then, is it not true that the essence of the matter can follow from this? We can spend some time describing how the Waldorf School came about, how it was established. We can describe how 30 instructors in Dornach in the collegiate level courses attempted to fructify science in the ground of spiritual science. In this case, when you say to them that science should be fructified, people do not have to think about how this would specifically happen in chemistry or in botany, but they can have faint imaginations about it while you speak. And so, then, they have a little time to put their thinking to bed in the midst of the thoughts that you are presenting. We have then reclaimed the possibility of talking about somewhat complicated things for the next 5 minutes. And the other topics are extremely useful anyway. If, for example, we explain to people how we did the evaluations in the Waldorf School, how we tried not to simply write, quote, almost satisfactory, quote, close quote, barely sufficient, you really cannot tell the difference anyway between whether someone has done something in a barely or hardly sufficient manner, but rather wrote something like a short biography of each child, along with a personal adage or saying for life. People do not need to think very much about how hard that is, which is to say they can see very easily how hard it is to find an adage appropriate to every child. But if you just tell them the results, then it is quite easy and painless for them to receive that. And in the same way, we can also tell people something about the founding of the Waldorf School, how the building slowly proved to be too small, how we had to build sheds because we did not have the money to build a proper building. It is useful for people to hear sometimes that we did not have enough money. This could have fortunate results. If we introduce such things into our considerations, it will first of all be necessarily material, for these are all relevant things. Their presence will be clearly justified. But this is also a way in which we can create a pleasant break and diversion for the audience. Then we can tell them about the college-level courses in Dornach, in Stuttgart. We can weave in the fact that all of that currently must be led by overworked Waldorf teachers, that very few people have so far gathered together who are able to read something out of anthroposophical spiritual science. The fact that the Waldorf teachers are working 3 times as much as they should, this is something that people can understand pretty easily, can they not? Each of them then fancies that he or she is also working too much. In this way, by speaking about something that is already out there in the world, we can show people something that they will perhaps be happy to hear about, while at the same time communicating something that they should know, that they need to know. And then we can talk to them also about the Commenda Talk. We should try to give them a picture how this Commenda Talk is organized. You can see this organization clearly in the leaflets that have been distributed. We should introduce people to the concept behind the Commenda Talk with these leaflets, and say to them, quote, "Of course, you will find that this Kommendatag does not yet conform fully to the idea of an association," close quote. We will talk more about associations tomorrow, quote, "that it is still formed on the basis of the present economy," close quote. But we should say to people at the same time, quote, "even though we know this, it shows us even more how necessary it is that this economy change, because even with the best intentions, it is not possible to form an ideal association on the basis of present-day economic life," close quote. It is also necessary for you to grasp our movement as a whole in your lectures. You should not feel embarrassed about presenting one side, the spiritual side, the anthroposophical orientation of our work, then going into the practical matters of the Kommendatag, and presenting all of that to people. In the lectures that you give, you need not go straight to asking for money. I say this to you parenthetically, but that can be done by another person who comes along and approaches people for the first time after the lecture. It goes better that way. And although I say this to you parenthetically, that is nevertheless how it should happen. As I said, you need not directly advertise for our movement in your lecture, but you can indicate that in order to meet the demands and intentions of threefolding, without there being any self-serving interests in the background, what is needed is, first, money, second, money, and third, money. And whenever one or the other of you finds the right situation in which to say this, you might, when repeating that word, money, three times, emphasize the first iteration more, and then speak with a falling or rising tone on the second iteration. This is something that can in some way bring something beneficial to the inner formation of it. I say that to you only as a way of indicating that you must pay attention to the way in which you say something. In a certain sense, every time you go into a lecture hall, you feel it out to understand whether you should speak in one way or another. You can still sort of feel this out, even when you are in a room full of people you do not know. And so you must always pay attention to such things. If you want to achieve precisely what must be achieved at present, you will not do so by stepping before a group of people with a finished concept. Rather, you must always orient yourself toward relationships between people. You will be able to do this only by having the kind of bearing toward the form and experience of your lectures that I described to you yesterday. At the same time, you should not forget to point out again and again the things that we have already managed to accomplish in the founding of the school and our practical institutions. Right now, this is precisely what people need, and you do them good when describing the threefold social organism to use the development of the Waldorf School as an illustration of it. The same is true when you are describing economic life. You should use the example of what we are trying to accomplish with the Kommendatag. I absolutely do not want you to forget that the world must be made aware of our various institutions through your lectures. And behind all of this must lie the consciousness that in every corner of the world, I have already said this multiple times in these lectures, there is a force of opposition that will only continue to grow, and that we do not have a very long time to bring about all that we want to bring about, and all that must be brought about. We must tackle these things in the near future. We cannot follow the example of how the anthroposophical movement has progressed thus far. I am saying this now for those who have been in the anthroposophical movement for a while, for at least in part it has progressed in such a way that its members have far too little interest in what is actually happening in the world around them. Now we are living in a time in which a keen interest in everything happening in the world must be developed. And we have to exemplify what we are bringing, as well as take a critical stance toward everything occurring on a day-to-day basis in the world. This is why we have to interest ourselves in these occurrences. We must seek to demonstrate the necessity of our movement on their basis. We must stress over and over that these events are likely to lead modern civilization toward its downfall. People must understand that if they continue to move forward on the present course, the downfall of modern civilization will most certainly result. the European countries, at the very least, will experience terrible times if we do not lay the foundation for a new society out of a truly active spiritual life and an actively understood political and economic life. We also have to take away certain phrases from people, ones that always go something like this, quote, "Yes, that might be well and good with the threefold social organism and all, but in order to bring something like that about, you would need decades, if not centuries." Close quote. This is a frequent objection. There is, however, no more ridiculous objection than this one. The things that are to come about in humanity, particularly when it comes to social institutions, are entirely dependent upon what human beings want and how much strength and courage they set behind their will toward it. And institutions that might last for centuries due to carelessness and inaction can be overturned in a moment by the use of active powers. But this is exactly why it is necessary for us to bring to people what comes out of our spiritual science, and that can arise through the examination of our present institutions. Do not forget to tell them about the kinds of things that are to come into being here in Stuttgart, for example, the Medical Therapeutic Institute. It might be the case that some people will learn best about the fruits of spiritual science, at least at first, from such institutions. When working at making something like this plausible for other people, we must also take into consideration the fact that it will not further humanity's development to establish, amidst the perspectives of old Catholicism or Evangelicalism or Judaism or the Turkish religions, to establish amidst these sectarian views an anthroposophical worldview. This would certainly be significant for those people who would get together once or twice every week to discuss the questions of that worldview. It would have a subjective significance for these people, but it would have no meaning for the world at large. Only a worldview and an understanding of life that takes hold of eminently practical questions will have any significance for the world as a whole. We will find all too often these days that people are very happy to talk about the eternal in human nature or about life after death. You can even talk with a large number of people now about reincarnation and karmic law and not see them fall asleep in boredom. But it is more useful and also more important to make people understand that anthroposophical, spiritual science can bring something to medicine, for example, or to therapy, so that people can really see how the things that we take hold of in the spiritual world have a unique significance for the material world. It is not simply a matter of elevating oneself to the plane of spirit and abstraction. Rather, it is a matter of elevating oneself in such a way that the spiritual world comes alive and has sufficient strength and power to move into the material world. This thought, this interpolation of the spiritual into the material world, in a multitude of different ways, you should lay this out before people over and over again. Spirit wants to govern matter, not flee from it. That is why it is blasphemous in a certain sense when someone like Brunn, in his little book titled Theosophy and Anthroposophy, admonishes anthroposophy for wanting to bring all the things supposedly floating about in the heights of heaven above reality, things that are not supposed to be part of material reality, to bring these things into everyday life. It is hard to think of worse corruptors of human life than those teachers who stand at lecterns in universities and teach people nonsense like this. But this happens every day in a wide variety of ways. And it is in keeping with the order of the day that people then come forward and say, quote, "Well, anthroposophy might be an attempt to deepen the individual branches of science, but anthroposophy has nothing to do with religion, with Christianity." Close quote. And then people step up and try to prove that anthroposophy has nothing to do with Christianity or religion. They come and they present totally arbitrary ideas that they have about religion and Christianity, and they make it clear that no one is allowed to shake up these concepts that they have about religion and Christianity. If only people could be truthful, then it might actually be possible to be somewhat charitable toward them. If they were to come forward and say, quote, now Anthroposophy has come on the scene. It is speaking out of different sources than the ones that I have been speaking out of at the theological lectern or the pulpit. I have to choose between giving up my job, but then I have nothing to eat, which would be terrible, and continuing to do my job while denying Anthroposophy. Close quote. You would not be able to take people like this particularly seriously when it came to our cultural life. But they would be speaking truthfully, just like the law teacher in Graz spoke truthfully when he proved the existence of human free will to his students by saying, quote, human beings have free will, because if they did not have free will, then they would not have any responsibility for their actions. And if they did not have any responsibility for their actions, then there would be no punishment in penal code. But I am the teacher of penal code. If there were no free will, then I would not be holding a lecture on the penal code. But that is precisely what I have to do. And since there must be someone like me at this university, then there must be a penal code, which means that there must be punishments, which means that people must be responsible for their actions, which means that human beings must have free will. Close quote. This is more or less how this law teacher in Graz proved the existence of human free will to his students for years. That is basically what he said. And theologians, among others, would say something similar, if they were being truthful. They too could present the other side of the issue, and then we might be more charitable toward them. They might say, quote, I could possibly take on the uncomfortable task of founding religion and Christianity anew, close quote. For university professors, it could happen that if the theology faculty was large enough, some of them might have to move over into the philosophy department. If they were already professors, this would be easier than if they were coming to a university for the first time. But keeping up a living would still be difficult, and they do not want to take on the uncomfortable task and the work of founding these things anew. If, however, they would only say this out loud, then they would be honest, at the very least. Instead, they say all manner of things that do not actually speak to reality, but rather serve a purely decorative function, covering up reality and hiding it. In these matters, we may not allow ourselves to be indulgent or charitable. When it comes to these matters, we must seek out untruthfulness and corruption in all the dark corners of the world, and show it relentlessly to the world. And we must also not forget to point out the slipshod thought that some people exhibit when they refuse to face up to certain claims in all of their moral complexity and depth. It was not long ago that someone heard how I publicly described the baseless lies of Frohnmeyer, who quite simply described something in Dornach in a lying, biased manner, something that actually looks much different than the biased way in which he characterized it. And this someone said, well, Frohnmeyer really believed that it looked that way. For me, it is not simply a matter of pointing out that Frohnmeyer said something untrue in this case. My concern is rather that Frohnmeyer is demonstrating that he makes claims about something in Dornach that fly in the face of reality. What he does in one instance, he does in every other. He is a theologian. He lectures at Basel University. This theologian draws from sources claimed to be sources of truth. Those who bear witness like Frohnmeyer did, those who describe the statue of Christ as he did, show that they have no understanding of how one discovers the truth in these sources. If Napoleon's birth and death dates were not written down in history books, Frohnmeyer would speak falsehoods about these facts too, if he had to discover them himself. This is my concern, to portray all of the corrupting effects of such people on this historical moment, to demonstrate that they are not fit for the positions given to them by the chaotic circumstances of the present. We may not be charitable when it comes to such things. These are things that will be part of the development of your work in the coming weeks. The end of Lecture 7.